And welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. I'm Chris Lucian, and we have our co-host, Austin Chadwick, here. And today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Richard Sheridan, who I know from the book Joy Inc. and a number of, everything that he does in Menlo. And so, Richard, maybe you can kind of intro yourself, and then we can talk a little bit about joy and other things related to that. So maybe Rich, go ahead.
Awesome. Well, great to be with you guys today. Thanks for inviting me into your world. I am the CEO and co-founder of Menlo Innovations. We're a custom software design and development firm here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. God willing, this June, we will turn 20 years old. I didn't think that it would be quite the challenge to get across the 20-year boundary, but given what's happened in the last year, we would have certainly been tested as a business. And so I know we'll have a delightful talk about things that bring us together, the three of us, in terms of your thoughts about how to run software teams and ours. And I know there's a lot of fun topics we can get in on related to that.
Awesome. Yeah. And it was one thing to note real quick. It was, we had a great time visiting Menlo, and then Menlo got to visit Mob with us, which was a lot of fun. And maybe one thing that we noticed, someone who's on my Mob, after we visited Menlo, he was just like, wow, everyone seems so happy and joyous there. And I'm like, yeah, there, you know, that's maybe why there's a book about it. So maybe that'll lead us right into the business value of joy. What were you thinking there?
Yeah, you know, joy is a weird word to use in a business context for sure. And it catches people's attention because they're like, whoa, this is work. Why are you talking about joy? Because typically we find joy elsewhere in our lives than we do in our workplaces. And yet, you know, as you think about like Simon Sinek's work, start with why. You know, why do you exist? What do you believe? That sort of thing. We, from our very beginning, from the first days of Menlo, we had decided we wanted to return joy to software development. Yeah. With a very explicit definition of what it means to deliver joy in the work that we do as engineers. And that is ultimately to serve others, to delight people with the work we do. I honestly believe there is only one thing that thrills the heart of a software engineer, and that is to see their work complete, get out into the world, and delight the people it's intended to serve. Anything short of that, and we're compromising. Anything short of that, we're seeking joy elsewhere, either outside of work or some weird thing inside of work, like where's my office, what's my title, how big is my paycheck, how many stock options do I have? But ultimately, if we boil it down, joy for our community comes from actually having a chance to do good work, deliver it to the world, and have people later come back and tell us, I love what you created. And that's our thrill. That's where we get our joy. And so I started speaking about this well over 10 years ago, about this idea of welcome to Menlo. When people come on tours, I see you've come to a place that has very intentionally created a culture focused on the business value of joy. And I got a lot of weird work looks in the first few times I said that. And they'd say, Rich, we're here to learn about how you design and build software. You take this unique approach, but why are you talking about joy? And I pointed back to this room behind me, room full of people. And I said, well, pretend you were bringing a software project to us. Pretend that half of that team back there had joy and the other half for some odd reason didn't. Tell me which half you'd want working on your software project. And people are like, well, of course we'd want the joyful half. I said, why? Why do you care? What difference would it make? And the answers they gave told the story. You'd be more productive. You'd care more about the outcome. You'd produce better results, higher quality. You'd be easier to work. And I said, okay, so you're with me. There is, in fact, tangible business value to joy. And we do tours. We still do tours, virtual ones now. It's what you guys got a chance to experience. But we get 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people a year come through our doors from all over the world just to see how we do what we do. And when I tell them what I just said, I say, now we're going to go look at Menlo. You've heard our why. Now I'm going to show you our how. Because how is really important. I said, anything I show you or not show you, because there's some things we don't do as well, you can ask me, Rich, what does that have to do with joy? And I tell you, I can draw a short, straight line back to joy. It's that important. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we characterize it and why people come and visit and want to see us and read books about joy and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, one thing that really kind of resonates with me, I think, you know, one thing that I decided I wanted to seek, and this is about 8 years ago or so, but I noticed just in my career as a software developer, I noticed that every environment I'd been in had kind of been miserable a little bit, right? It was the opposite of joy, right? And so, you know, one thing I resolved to do is just kind of, you know, not kind of put up with a non-joyful environment. I don't know, it wasn't articulated in those words back then, yep. But it really was what it was, right? You know, so people getting mad at each other over, you know, having KPIs compared in front of people, between people and things like that, just pitted against each other, right? Like these manipulative tactics that you might see in traditional business environments. And so, you know, one thing that I think I was seeking is the, you know, the absence of that pain, right? And a lot of that then led to thinking, you know, how do we make things better in some way? And so, you know, I think I, at one point, was just thinking, how does the software industry, how do software developers get to the point where they're not, you know, doing death marches all the time and things like that, right?
And the problem with those death marches, as we well know, if you've been in this industry for any amount of time, is they lead to more problems,
yeah.
Right? I drew a graph one time for a CEO at a company who was really struggling with the performance of his software team. And he was doing these, you're going to have it done by June 4th or else, you know, and I looked at him and says, or else what? Right. And I said, look, let me draw a graph of effort on one part and time on another. And as you get closer to deadline, the effort line keeps climbing and finally almost goes towards infinity towards the end of a project. And at that point I said, look, let's draw the area under the curve as you approach infinity. I said, in that area, when effort is going through the roof, when hours are hitting 60, 70, 80, 90 hours a week, not unusual for software teams. I said, in that area under the curve, are planting the seeds of destruction for this software. You will be dealing with quality issues for a decade in those few months of work that you won't be able to overcome because your customers will see it. You'll lose market share. You'll have unhappy customers. You'll have demoralized team members. I said, we need a different approach if we're going to actually succeed. And the way I would define success in that is to delight people with the work that we do.
Yeah. And that, your definition of joy in the software or business context really resonates. And it reminds me of a story when I first, my first internship, I was in college for computer science, and then I was interning somewhere. And I was talking to a developer analyst, and this was several organizations ago, obviously, but, and the first thing, one of the first things he said to me was, man, back when our department first started out, it was so much fun. I would make something, deliver it to someone, and they would be so excited about what I make for them, and they'd ask for more. And it was this quick flow of creating value for each other. And then he was saying, like, now, you know, we have, you know, a million things of red tape, and to change a database column, it takes 50 approvals and 50 process steps. And I'm just not happy anymore. and so, yeah, you're right. When the work you do generates value for someone, it really is a motivating thing for software development. And and for me, mobbing and joy has kind of gone together, because as I've gone through different parts of my career, experimented with mobbing and now doing it full time, I could see the if you graphed it on a curve with joy, the joy was higher when the mobbing was going on. And I think for a lot of reasons we talked about on the show, it's able to generate that value for the people working and also for the people you're delivering the product for. And so, yeah, I just wanted to share that. That it's one of the first lessons I learned, but I didn't really note it at that time.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think we all had those experiences. This is probably what drew us into the industry in the first place. Mm-hmm. I spent the first 20 years of my career writing code. It's a very enjoyable, honorable activity. It's hard work, which I think is one of the reasons we like it. You know, we're the type of people that are entranced by exacting levels of detail and making sure we've thought through all the edge cases and that it'll be stable at every stage of the way. But eventually our practices, our processes, our methods, our approaches start to deteriorate the quality part of things. And then we start scrambling to try and get something out the door, and then we shove it out. And I remember, back in the 90s, the typical thing was just ship it. We'll fix it later. You know what? Later never came. It never came. Right. And then later the bosses would say, well, I never told you to produce bad quality. Like, yeah, well, true. I mean, from a legal definition, I couldn't stand in front of a judge and say, they told me to produce crap code. But let me tell you, everything in the sequence was almost guaranteed to do that. And I'll tell you, for me, there was a juncture where I wanted out of the industry entirely. I didn't even want to be in it anymore because that joy part was robbed from me. I didn't even have that word back then. You know, but it was just that feeling like, this isn't why I got in the industry. I didn't just go in to firefight all day. I didn't just go in to punch keys on a keyboard. I wanted to change the world with my hands, with the work of my mind and my heart.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And maybe before jumping topics, I had one question. So what led you to kind of discover or cash it in terms of joy? You know what I mean? So you said before you didn't really know it in that kind of way. What kind of led you to focusing in on that as a key indicator?
Yeah, it was a couple of moments. One that I was reminded of much later on. But we have been doing tours and classes and teaching. We share with the world like you guys do with what we've learned. And I think that's a really remarkable positive of our industry. Is it's not like we're selfishly discovering something and holding on to it. Yeah. Those of us who are actually at the forefront of changing this industry and our methods, we want to share with others what we've learned. That's why there's these big conferences and we all present about the things we're trying and how it's working and can we improve and can we learn from others. I mean, that's a really delightful part of our industry. And so early on, that was our decision. We're going to open our doors. We're going to invite people in. We're going to share with them what we learned. We had a mission statement on the wall that, like a lot of companies do. And then eventually somebody who had heard me speak said, hey, Rich, I just saw this video by Simon Sinek on Start With Why. And you guys do that. You start with your why, then you go to your how, then maybe you talk about your what. And I thought about it. I thought, no, I really don't. I mean, if somebody had come into Menlo in the old days, I would say, hey, we're a software design and development firm. That's what we do. And we have all these weird practices, pair programming and open and collaborative environment, so on and so forth. And but I would never actually speak to the why part.
Yeah.
And, but they can infer it. You know, they could hear it in my energy. I said the word joy every now and then. And then when this guy sent me this video and said, you do this, I thought, you know what? Simon Sinek is right. We should start with why. What would I say? So I looked at our old mission statement that had been there almost from our founding. This was probably 10 years in. And we talk about ending human suffering in the world as it relates to technology. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But right down at the bottom, it was like waiting there for me like a gift. It said, our goal since our founding in 2001 is to return joy to one of the most unique endeavors mankind has ever undertaken, the invention of software. Because let's face it, I don't know if you've had this experience as I have. I have tried to explain for my entire time I've known my father-in-law, and it's been over 40 years now, who came out of tool and die work in the automotive industry. And he's like, what do you do again? Like, well, we write software, Dan. Well, what do you mean write software? Well, you know, we tell the computer what to do. And he looks at me and goes, no, the computer tells you what to do. it's really hard to explain software to people who aren't programmers, right? I mean, this is a crazy thing we do. I mean, is it, you know, I'd say, oh, it's like the soul of the machine. You know, it's like, what? What do you mean the soul of the machine? How does it work? Are there gears? Are there switches? Are that's, well, no, there's just ones and zeros. Well, how does that work? You know, it's like, it's really hard to do. Software is different. You can't actually touch it, mm-hmm. right? You don't see it until the results are there. And all of those things for me just led me to this path that said, you know what? I got to remember why I got into this industry in the first place. And quite frankly, I had to go back before I even touched a computer. And I thought about this moment with my mom and dad when I was about 10 and they had gone out to a dinner and a movie. And there was this IKEA-like bookshelf out in the garage that my mom was really excited about having in the living room. And I went out in the garage that night when they were away and I built it. Nice. 200 pieces of wood and little nuts, bolts, and screws and everything. I'm sure it wasn't that much, but it felt like it when you were 10, right? and then I'm so excited because I thought, oh, I did it. I built this thing. My mom is going to love. And then I thought, oh, crap, I built it in the garage and in the living room, right? So over the next hour, I inched that thing out to the front of the garage, down the sidewalk, through the kitchen, into the living room. I pushed it right where mom wanted it. I set up dad's books, mom's knickknacks, the stereo, and I had it playing her favorite album when she came in the door.
Nice.
And she cried. And in that story is the essence of what I was talking about earlier. Joy is in serving others. Joy is this idea that when we do things and we do stuff that 99% of the other planet looks like it's black magic, right? Yeah. I mean, think about it, right? We make a machine do stuff we want it to do. Most people can't do that. And their mind is blown when they're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you get to do that all day long. I love this thing. Imagine how Zoom engineers feel right now, right? Like saved us from the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
And so that idea of serving others is where this seed of joy was really planted. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, again, I think, you know, you've seen it, you probably have experienced it like I have. After a while, when that gets traded away, when you don't get that, you start looking for, well, I need a faster computer. I need a bigger screen. I need two screens. I need an office with a door that closes. I want people to leave me alone. I want a big title. I want a big paycheck.
Yeah.
All of those are false rewards. I honestly believe that people who do what we do for a living, if they got to experience the kind of joy we regularly do at Menlo, they'd do it for free if they could. Mm-hmm. Because yeah. It's just such a delightful activity when you get to do it well.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I agree that I've experienced it as well. When you switch kind of the mindset, even just like in day-to-day work, instead of like, oh, what can I get out of my coworkers and out of my work today for me? You know what I mean? As opposed to, hey, how can I serve and help others? And that switch to kind of servant leadership or servant programmership or however you want to call it, right? How can I best help my team? Joy seems to come a lot easier. It's kind of, I think I'm stealing from C.S. Lewis a little bit, but where it comes as a side effect, but if you pursue it directly, you kind of lose it. But yeah. If you serve others, it comes along for the ride, so to speak, often. And so, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, and the fact of the matter is that when we do the work we do, it's hard, it's long, it can be frustrating. I don't want to conflate joy and happiness because there's a lot of unhappiness along the way to build great software.
Right. Right.
The tool isn't working quite right. The frameworks you grab don't work the way you expect, or, you know, work you rely on from others, you know, all that kind of stuff. This is hard work. And the fact of the matter is, and the reason you guys, you know, go down the mob path and we have focused so much of our attention on pairing and switching pairs, which is kind of our version of mobbing, I suppose. Yeah. This is a team activity now. It's not possible for individual heroes anymore to create great software. It was in my earliest days, you know, Gates and Allen built the first version of DOS. I won't say it was that good. I don't think they were good programmers, quite frankly. But the fact matter is, two guys could work together for 3 months and create an operating system.
Yeah.
When Microsoft does that now, it's 10,000 people for 5 years.
Yeah. Absolutely. The addition of the complexity can slow you down, and then you don't get that in the instant kind of feedback, right? And so I think we spend a lot of time and effort lately making sure that we can get positive or constructive feedback as quickly as possible. And that's part of it, right? Is to just see people light up and just say like, hey, that thing just moved now, and that's a lot better than it was before. And you get that kind of that cycle. And I think, you know, a big focus for me is just maintaining that cycle. You know, iterative development in general has more of that, you know, steady kind of.
Well, it's systems thinking, right? It's short communication and feedback loops.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Think of all the projects we used to work on where we wouldn't get feedback for a year or two before we found out, well, that's not what we need. Well, it's what you asked for. Yeah, but it's not what we need. Like,
it's very likely that most of the software industry is still in that world. And
oh, absolutely.
It's just hard to fathom now.
I'm sure you guys run into that with the guests you entertain. We're like, we just had this big failure. Really? What was it like? Well, we spent 5 years spending, you know, $10 billion creating this big piece of software. Well, what happened? Oh, it's total failure. We have to start all over. Like, And that is just, I'm not sure anybody who's not in the industry can fathom how demoralizing that is to a technical team.
Yeah.
Because that's the opposite of joy, right? When this hard work you've done, where you tried as hard as you could to do it well, and it just gets sort of pushed off the ship into the ocean to sink. And then the leaders come around and say, but don't worry, guys, we got another project lined up for you.
Yeah. And that's a good point, right? The analysis of you know, whether pay actually equals joy or not, right? So those people that basically had all of their work kind of thrown away, they likely have big paychecks. They likely mm-hmm. have, you know, everything that they need in their personal lives, but it's still it's saddening, right, to see all of that hard work go for nothing, even while you're getting paid for it, right? And
if you think about pay, the traditional word we use for pay is compensation.
Yeah.
Well, where else do we have to compensate? Is like, if a table is out of balance, if one of the legs is too short, we have to compensate by putting something under that leg. The reason we pay people is because, quite frankly, most of them would rather be doing something else than what they're doing for their job, but they have to. So we have to compensate them for the pain we've caused in their lives.
Yeah.
The less pain we cause, you know, and I'm not saying we should, you know, we have to pay people a fair wage and that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is, if the only reason we're keeping people on our team is because we're, you know, they said, well, I'm quitting after this project. No, we really need you. Here's a big raise. Here's more stock options. That actually embitters people.
Yeah.
Because eventually they get priced out of the market and now they're trapped in their current position.
The golden handcuffs.
Humans do not like to be trapped.
And maybe that's a good transition to our next topic, which is ending human suffering in the world as it relates to technology and teams. So I think you've already started to dip your toes into this one or jump in, but please, what were you thinking here?
So for us, we look at three traditional constituents around a software project. The people who pay for the work to be done, mm-hmm. who don't know how to build software, so they're reliant on some other people, either a department inside their own company or an external firm like Menlo. The people who ultimately use the software every day, and then the people who do the work. And all three of those constituencies in the traditional broken industry we're in suffer, right? Mm-hmm. You have executives who are spending millions of dollars on a project with absolutely nothing to show for it. I was in with a client the other day and he said, Rich, we have gone around the ERP mountain for our manufacturing firm twice now, $2 million each time, nothing to show for it, zero. Right? $4 million, nothing to show for it. Can you imagine the mounting frustration, especially when you can't actually, as an executive, a CEO, as he was, is trying to cajole the technical team. Could you do it right this time? Could you just give us what we need, right? And there's a tremendous amount of suffering. And quite frankly, this is the place I believe, Chris, that iterative and incremental emboldens the sponsors, because now they can see tangible progress, right? I mean, one of my standard jokes about programmers is they have as many different definitions for done as, you know, Alaskans have words for snow. Right. Yes. And, you know, it's done, but it's not finished. It's finished, but it's not ready. It's ready, but it's not complete. Right. And the executives, come on now. Can't you get it done? Right. And then the people who end up using the software. Right. I mean, even us as technologists are tortured by technology regularly. Mm-hmm. Right. Whether it's the IDEs we use or frameworks, but even simple things. I found myself after the chip reading credit card machines came out in the earliest days, how frustrated I was just to do a credit card transaction. Yeah. It was like there'd be this little chevron basically enticing me, swipe me, swipe me, swipe me. So I'd swipe and they'd be, oh, I'm sorry, sir, it's a chip machine. Well, then why was the chevron? Oh, I don't know, you gotta ignore that. Just put your, then I put my chip in and I wouldn't put it in far. Oh, sir, you haven't put it in far enough. And so I tap it in and they go, oh no, sir, you gotta pull it out and put it in again. Like, okay. And then, you know, of course it starts blinking, you know, do not remove card, do not remove card, do not remove card. And every time the screen changed, I'm like ready to pull it out. And if you do, you're putting like a 1 minute penalty box. And by the time I get done with a credit card transaction that actually, you know, some people have done analysis that credit card typically registers as pleasure because you're not actually paying for it yet. And now it registers as pain.
Yeah.
And I remember having a credit card company come into Menlo once about that. Not about that, but I just was describing to them, as you're asking me about suffering, and I used the credit card example. And of course, here was their beautiful answer. They said, oh, Rich, that's not us. That's Verifone. That's the credit card processing company. And I looked at him and said, sorry, guys, whole world connected. I associate this pain with your product.
Yeah.
And then I looked at him once and I said, hey, Apple has $300 billion in cash in the bank. You think they might become a credit card company someday? And I said, because I put my credit card in here already, and it went back to pleasure, because now all I have to do is beep beep. And my daughter has an Apple Watch. I don't have one yet because I haven't worn a watch for 4 years, and she just can like just swipe her watch over the thing and it's going beep, all done, so pleasure. And I said, do you realize that me putting your credit card in this is a temporary situation for Apple, and eventually they'll put their own credit card here, and then you guys are disintermediated, and then we'll wonder, hey, do you remember there were credit card companies? You know. So anyways, so that's the second kind of suffering. How do we take care of the users? We had to create an entirely separate design thinking oriented practice for that, that we uniquely named high tech anthropology. Mm-hmm. Because if we're going to get software to work for people, guess what? We have to understand people, and that's what anthropologists do. So our anthropologists go out into the world, they study the people in their native environment, learn their workflow, their habit, their goals as human beings, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, it's finally, really important.
The type of suffering we want to end is for the people who do the work.
Yeah.
I mean, how many of us have, you know, all-nighters were common for me. And then later for the people who work for me. You know, work through the weekend. Take a laptop with them on vacation, right?
Bring a pillow to work.
Yeah, right. The sleeping bag, right? Yeah. And it's like, and then, you know, okay, I think we'd actually be willing to work that hard. And then the project gets shoved off the deck of the ship into the ocean.
Yeah.
You're like, wait a minute. I probably screwed up some personal relationships in my life because of all this overtime. I've missed three of my kids' important events, or, you know, or they don't know dad anymore, or mom. And now the work gets pushed off the ship. And so those are the three sort of pillars of suffering: people who pay for it, the people who ultimately use it, and the people who do the work. And so everything at Menlo is centered around those three stanchions of suffering and eliminating it, and then getting us in a position to get us back to that joy.
Mm. Oh, fantastic. Yeah. And I think you both have hit on iterative development, and just to share my experience, it's amazing how much lack of joy and lack of trust can exist amongst those three parts of the stool. I don't know if you didn't, but it's amazing just how, if you show up on a team where those three parts are interacting and you just start demoing value daily, you know what I mean? How instantly joy starts happening and how instantly trust starts forming, right? And I think maybe there's one tie to joy and trust, right? So, and trust is very essential between the users, the people making it, and the people paying for it, right? And so, just from experience, the once you start making that work, it's like it starts multiplying on top of itself, right? You know, the people are having fun, there's value being delivered, there's joy, and then there starts having trust, and a lot of issues start melting away. What are some things that you've seen as well that ends suffering and relates to technology and teams that kind of helps those three parts work well?
Well, you know, it's funny how the industry, probably through Dilbert comics and that sort of thing, has gotten a sort of a mental model that people who aren't in the industry believe about us as software people. Yeah. They think we want to be in sensory deprivation chambers with lights down low and headphones on and don't interact with other human beings, come in at weird hours so we don't actually have to talk to anybody. And of course, that is the case for a lot of developers, that's how they work. And people will come to us and say, well, how do you get people to work like this? It's like, you know, did you like corner the market on extroverted programmers? Like, no, these are all deep introverts here. No, they can't possibly be. Look at how much they're talking to one another. Say, look, introverts don't prefer sensory deprivation and isolation. What they prefer are fewer, safer, deeper relationships with other people. And they get that here. And, you know, if we talk about trust, and I agree with you, that underlies everything, right? Because in many ways, the opposite of trust is fear, mm-hmm. right? If I don't trust you, I'm afraid of you. Mm-hmm. And that fear may not be explicit, but I'm going to stop sharing information if I think I will be harmed later, even with a tough word or a raised eyebrow or a heave and a sigh or a yelling and a swearing at a meeting or something like that. So after a while, I just stop sharing information. After a while, I'm like, you know what? I'd like to come in at midnight and work till 8 a.m. Then I don't have to, you know, I'll get in the flow then. Well, I think what they really want is I just don't want to deal with people yelling at me all day long, right? But trust is an interesting thing. Trust can only be built over time. And I think it requires time spent with other people. We can only build relationships if we spend time with one another. If we get enough time and build enough relationship, we'll get teamwork. Then we'll get collaboration, and then we'll get trust. And it's a good sequence. It works every time. We humans are wired to work together. We really are. I mean, I have two fundamental beliefs about human beings in general. Number one, we are wired to work. We actually enjoy it. It feels good, right? Yeah. And number two, we are wired to work in collaboration with others to work on something that's bigger than we could ever do by ourselves. And so what you guys are doing with mobbing, what we've been doing all of our time pairing in a big open collaborative work environment, you now get that team flow. You know, I'm sure you get these questions all the time. Well, what about individual flow? And I'm like, I don't care about individual flow. That won't get my project done. I need the team like a sculling, you know, like a rowing team to be rowing together. And I don't need a really strong guy in the left side or we'll be going in circles all the time. I need a team that knows how to pull together and work as a team and glide down that river faster than everybody else.
That's entirely true. Like the, you know, one thing you said about the, you know, did you corner the market on extroverted programmers? Like, I think even in our environment, we get that question a lot. And there have been kind of experience reports on introverted mobbing and things like that as well. But a big thing that we look for is kind of to not have the heroes, right? Like, and the heroes, you know, rather than being the hero on the project, you know, getting the last thing done at the last moment and writing a bunch of stuff that no one understands, they're out there coaching others on how to become better themselves, right? And so I think early on, one of the things that we did when we were scaling the mobbing stuff was kind of put in a policy that, you know, more senior developers are expected to coach more and bring other people up as often as possible. And as you get those interactions, then the whole team comes up together. And so,
which is a great servant leadership process.
Yeah.
Where my job is to be the least important person here and help all of you succeed. Yeah. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. The one thing that jumped out to me that, I haven't, read the whole book, but, there's this book called The Boys in the Boat, and it's about a team in the 1936 Berlin Olympics, and they describe rowing, and it's just phenomenal. Like, I'll read one quote here, but it's just phenomenal, the relation to teams and pairing and mobbing. It was like, what mattered more than how one person rowed was how everything well he did, he harmonized with the boat and the other people. He couldn't harmonize with his crewmates unless he opened his heart to them and he cared about his crew. And so it's like these people who've done rowing sharing about it, and it's just, it's almost one for one, like mobbing and pairing. And so it's just funny you shared that, because I just discovered that recently, but with the rowing. But yeah, I mean, it, you know, achieving something on your own is fun and it's good, but I feel like once you do it with others, that power of co-creation, it's just a whole nother level of joy and value, you know what I mean? And like you said, you can't really, it's too big of a task for one person. It's too heavy to lift.
Yeah, well, the only way to scale a hero-based organization is to scale the heroes. And the only way to do that is overtime. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, pick your number. I think it's around 45 to 50, but north of 50 hours, north of 55 for sure, you're putting more bugs in than you're taking out.
Yeah.
Because you're tired.
You're destroying out. Their personal lives. You're destroying their sleep habits.
Yeah.
They're, you know, they can only make progress on anything else outside of the work.
Yeah. And ultimately you become so one dimensional, you can't even like create anymore.
Yeah.
You've lost that human touch of creativity, imagination, invention, and innovation, which is quite frankly what everybody on the planet needs these days in their businesses.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think the other thing, and this was something I had dreamed about when I was young, I'm coming up on this can't be possible anniversary in September. It'll be 50 years since I typed my first line of code into a computer in 1971. Right. How's that possible? I'm not even 50 years old. And, but, you know, I always dreamed about the camaraderie and human energy that you get from people just working together. That sort of, I don't know, the teamwork part, you know, the same thing you get in sports equations and that sort of thing. It's just that feeling of, you know, that elation I think you get when you just work on things together, hard things.
Yeah. Solving problems together and then coming out the other side and having that shared memory of, you know, remember how difficult that was. We got through that. We can get through the next thing and the next.
Right. Next. Gives you stories to tell.
Yeah.
Well, we are coming up on time box a bit, but maybe we can get the lightning version of running experiments from Rich before we close here. So what were you thinking here?
Yeah. So for us, you know, a lot of people say, oh, how do you decide how you're going to work and that sort of thing. And so much of what we do is literally captured in a phrase. When somebody says, hey, I have this idea, you know, and rather than squashing it and saying, well, that's not the way we do things around here, you know, we'd have to form a committee to write a policy about that. Our team is like, I don't know, let's run the experiment. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how much anxiety it takes out of something you're trying. Because it says, well, it's an experiment. It should probably 50% of the time experiments should fail. And if they're not failing 50% of the time, we're probably being too careful. So it keeps pushing the team forward. And the simplest version of this is just this. Our team is inclined to take action versus take a meeting. And you guys have probably seen this in your own programming career. James and I, my co-founder and I, reflected on this in our earliest days at Menlo, where we would lament our times past where programmers would say, well, should we do it this way or that way? And they'd say, well, let's have a meeting. And they would sit in a room for 4 or 8 hours arguing about two simple competing approaches.
Yeah.
And James and I'd be like, why don't we just go write the code? Yeah. Rather than have the meeting, well, then we'd have to throw part of it away. It's like, so, you know, just go write the darn code and see what happens, right?
I've had those meetings where, you know, we come out of it and then we go write both of them, and writing both of them took half the time that the meeting took, right?
So everything at Menlo, every little thing we do, most of it was born out of those simple take action kind of experiments. And it also takes a lot of the fear out of the approach. People can start leading from anywhere. They don't have to be the top person anymore. They can just say, hey, you know what? If you can get one, at least one other person to join you in an experiment, it has a chance of fostering inside the team. And if it doesn't, no big deal. It's just an experiment.
Yeah. And one thing that I like to tell people is, you know, I like to ask people that come and visit, you know, how often are your experiments? And one thing that I think I've noticed through my career is that everybody kind of typically waits till there's an emergency to start experimenting. And so it's like, it gets that point where all hope is lost. And then everybody's like, I don't care what you try, let's just try anything. And so it's like, if you start experimenting now, you'll never get to that point where you have abandoned all hope and are just throwing out experiments left and right.
Yeah, it's an act of desperation.
Yeah. And so the idea is you know, how does an experiment make it into your system? How does a new good process enter your system? And sometimes, more importantly, how does a bad process exit your system? And is it even possible for it to happen? And I think a lot of people I talk to, the answer is no initially until they start thinking about it a little bit. And I wholeheartedly agree with that statement.
Well, and often the biggest inhibitor to trying new things is somebody saying, well, we've never done it that way before.
Yeah.
I was talking with a potential client the other day, and they're like, well, I think this pairing thing would be really hard. I mean, in terms of justifying the cost of it and the loss of efficiency. And I looked at them and said, compared to what? I said, hey, look, if all your projects are succeeding wildly, why are you even talking to us? Like, oh, yeah, we're failing a lot. Like, okay, you think you're open to maybe trying a different approach?
Something else, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's one thing, whether you're pairing or mobbing, that questions come up a lot. Like, well, if there's not a hierarchy of decision makers and then implementers of the decision, how do you make decisions, right? Like, I think that comes up a lot where people are like, well, how do you make a decision in a mob or a pair or in a team if there's not like the decider, right, so to speak? And I think what you said is the key to it, experiment, right? Once you start experimenting, the path becomes pretty clear. Often
especially
because
in an environment of trust, especially in an environment of trust.
Yeah.
You know, you said that earlier, that no question, that is like the foundation of what you guys are doing and what we're doing. It has to be built on trust. Mm-hmm. Because you're not going to try unusual things if you don't trust the people around you. You'll try safe things. You'll try only the things that are going to work. And that's not going to get you where you need to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are coming up on time, Box. Any other questions, Chris, or are we ready to close here?
No, I think I'm good. But maybe we start with if there's anything that you'd like to plug or promote kind of coming out of this discussion before we kind of move to the closing.
For us, one of the ways we share with the world is through our tours. And every year, thousands of people would come to Ann Arbor, get on airplanes, book hotel rooms, come stay with us for a day to a week, learning about our methods in either tours or workshops. And when the pandemic hit, of course, that all had to end for safety and health. And around about June, we were cajoled by a friend to try a virtual tour, and we did it, and it worked. And we have had visitors now from 43 countries and 35 states just in the last 6 months. And so my encouragement to your audience is, if they want to come see us, the basic public tours are free. Yeah. And you don't have to get on an airplane anymore. You can do it from the comfort of your own home. And so so just go on our website, click on tours and workshops tab, go take a free tour, come see us. We'd love to have you.
Yeah, we'll link it in the show notes. And I highly recommend it. You know, Austin and I have both been on that tour, and it's fantastic. And so it's worth the time for sure. Okay. So, you know, I want to encourage the audience to, you know, maybe share this video with anybody that you think could use a little bit more joy in their lives, especially in a software development role, or maybe convince them to add more joy if they're a leader of some kind to the environment. And, you know, we will see you next time. And as always, please like and subscribe. And thank you very much for joining us today. Bye, everybody.